I have to say, Vitra were really part of that conversation. It wasn't, you know, the classic designer, you know, doing a drawing on a napkin and walking away. It was a fight. It was a fight to get there, but it was a collaborative. It was a collaborative effort with the engineers, with the vision of Vitra, with, you know, and our own kind of passion to get the thing done. And finally, we ended up with this chair, which we really loved, but which was really complicated to make. You know, it's like it needs a piece of steel that's 20 tons. It has 7 moving parts. It's heated, it's air molded, and the investment was huge. I mean, you know, you could buy a house in London for the investment on the project. And we thought, at the same time, you know, you've got this thing where we actually had created something which looked slightly unfamiliar, and the interaction was also slightly unfamiliar. So it was risky.
Gleich geht's los mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast. Unser Werbepartner Way, den habt ihr schon mal in den letzten Wochen gehört und auch diese Woche wieder dabei. Worum geht's bei Way? Es geht um Hanf. Hanf, ja, aber nicht das Hanf, was dich breit macht. Way ist anders. Way, das sind Produkte, die dich auf die Spur bringen und dich in Balance halten. Es geht hier um die Cannabispflanze, also Produkte, die CBD enthalten. Also ganz egal, ob CBD-Pen, Gel, Kapselöl oder Bath Bomb. Die Idee von Way ist, dass Hanf gut zu dir ist, auf eine neue, achtsame Art. Und damit steckt eben das Beste von Hanf in allen Way-Produkten. Ihr findet das alles auf der Website Way, geschrieben vay.com. Dort bekommt ihr einiges. Und das kann Sachen sein, die ihr in den verschiedensten Momenten nutzen könnt. Zum Beispiel das Mundspray am Morgen, Kapseln nach dem Essen oder Sportgel nach der körperlichen Anstrengung. Oder zum Beispiel den CBD-Pen, den man diskret im Laufe des Tages einsetzen kann. Oder eben abends eine Bath Bomb zum Entspannen. Das alles ist das, was Way anbietet. Way ist ein Unternehmen in Berlin mit einem Team aus Forschern, Entwicklern, Biologen, Medizinern, Unternehmern, alle, die zusammen daran arbeiten, eben aus Hanf das Beste für euch rauszuholen. Also schaut mal auf die Seite way.com, vay.com, und jetzt viel Spaß mit On the Way to New Work.
Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von On the Way to New Work, unserem Podcast, den wir jetzt seit schon fast 3 Jahren machen. Neben mir sitzt
Christoph Magnussen.
Mein Name ist Michael Trautmann. Wir haben heute zu Gast Jay Osgoby.
Hi.
Einer der beiden Founding Partner von Barbara and Osgoby, einem berühmten Industrial Designer Duo aus London. Und weil Jay besser Englisch spricht als Deutsch, werden wir jetzt in die von uns ja auch geliebte Sprache Englisch switchen.
Ich nicht, sprechen Sie Deutsch.
Very good. Jay, we're so happy to have you here.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
In the Vitra showroom in Hamburg, which is on its way to become our second home.
Yes, definitely.
We're very proud and thankful that we can do it here. And we always start our podcast with a question. How did you become the person you are now?
I guess the years passed. How did I become a designer? I think there's a number of things that happened. One of them was growing up in the countryside, which meant that on a rainy day there wasn't so much to do, and so I found myself in the garden, in the shed. My father used to make things. My grandfather and my great-grandfather had been coach makers, so they used to make coaches for horses. And we had lots of tools that we'd inherited that were kind of chaotically arranged in the shed. So on a raining day, and thanks to the boredom of the 1970s, I found myself making things. Not particularly good things, but I enjoyed the process of putting things together. I like drawing. My mother was very much encouraged me to have a creative mind. Perhaps I was also helped by the fact that I'm kind of a bit dyslexic.
Welcome to the club.
Which of course makes you see the world in a different way, right? It's the superpower that no one talks about. Yeah. That was good. So all of those things led to a kind of, I guess, a desire to do something in the creative world. I didn't know what until I was 18 or 19, and I went to do a foundation course where you get to try everything: sculpture, fine arts, you know, ceramics, photography, fashion design.
And where did you do this?
Oxford Polytechnic. Oh,
and for how long was it? A year?
That was 1 year.
1 year.
And in that year, you then choose your future. So I, because of this love of making that I had, and I think it was mainly the fact that I also really enjoyed creating things that you interact with at the human scale. Mm-hmm. So things you hold in your hand and things you sit on, more perhaps than your environment in total. I decided to do industrial design and furniture design for my degree. And then, because I am slightly unhinged, I decided to do a master's in architecture.
Wow, that's a good combination.
Which is where I met Ed. Mm-hmm. Business partner. So that kind of hybridization of education led to a hybridization of our practice, you know, from the small things to buildings to urban planning to microchip related products. And we've never really seen any boundaries in what we can do as creative people.
And how did it start, like the work with Vitra, for example? So we enjoy your product right now. We sit mm-hmm. on it. I work on it every day. There is a long story behind it. We will probably share it. But
yeah.
From that passion to then like really getting to a job, saying yeah. like having the influence, the process behind it.
Well, it sounds like a made up story. But the truth, the real truth is that we, Ed and I, decided that Vitra was our kind of number one company. So this is back in 2001, 2002.
So directly after you finish your master degree in architecture, yeah. you started your own business.
Yeah, so that's yeah. right. Yeah, mm-hmm. So we graduated in 1994. We were lucky to, through a friend of a friend, we got a project to design a restaurant. We worked on the project. It was really well received, and the phone started ringing, and people were like, I love this place. How about you do this? And in parallel with that, we had designed our first piece, the loop table, for that very first project. Mm-hmm. And then Capellini discovered the loop table. It had been really beautifully prototyped by Isocon Plus. And suddenly we found that we had opportunities, like confronted with the range of the potential had opened from architecture to furniture professionally, and we had to decide which route to take. Anyway, at that moment when we started working with Capellini and the Italian scene opened, we were really huge fans of, we were really impressed, and we were huge fans of Vitra and Rolf and what they stood for. So we wrote a letter and said, as you did before email, we wrote a letter and said, "Dear Rolf, we really like what you do. It would be great to meet you." And he wrote back and said, "Yeah, come over. Come, let's have a meeting." So this was in 2004, and we got on well. And he said, "I'd like to work with you. I think we need to find the right start." He said, "I don't really know where to put you in my collection of people. I don't know where you fit." And we said, we don't either, really, because we're not, I mean, at that point, to be honest, we didn't really know what we were yet. We were just two people working together and enjoying the process. So time went on, and we were waiting for this perfect project to start. We were approached by the Royal Society of Arts to, because Ed and I were both made Royal Designers for Industry, which is an accolade that you have in the UK for people who do good work in the industrial arts. Because of that, they asked us to help them choose furniture for a school that they were building in as part of the Labour government's Building Schools for the Future programme, which was an ambitious programme to build 250 schools a year, which soon finished with the recession. But the Royal Society of Arts were building a school. They wanted us to help them find furniture for the school that was fit for the way that people are learning today. We looked, and there wasn't one. So we thought, oh my God, here's an amazing project. for Vitra. Vitra is the home of work. Kids are being taught more like we work now, through projects, through collaboration. It's not about sitting still and just writing mm-hmm. stuff down. Mm-hmm. So again, out wrote a letter. It might have been an email by now to Rolf and saying, I think we have a project. How about designing a new chair for education to help, you know, a chair that has movement but that has no mechanism? And he was like, great. And that's how we started with Vitra.
And that's the Tipton?
Tipton chair, yeah.
It's one of the questions we have to jump through now, but give a little bit of background, because I know Katinka is a big fan of that chair. She hates to sit still, so she was moving
me too.
Same with me.
Okay, I'm the only one here. No, I'm not. But to give a little bit of background, like that's a very interesting product.
So having had Vitra's agreement to, you know, go ahead with the project, we did loads of research. We visited lots of schools. We looked at academic research that had been carried out in the previous 20 years, 30 years about how your sitting position can impact your concentration. Mm-hmm. We also remembered ourselves of what it was like being in that classroom when we were kids, you know, and you just like the feeling of needing to move because it was so boring and frustrating, and like pushing back on your chair and getting told off. And we realized that actually the need to do this isn't anything to do with being a naughty kid. It's because you need to help the oxygen get to your brain. Otherwise, you just fall asleep, you know. So we, with those findings, we created a list of criteria that our new chair for Vitra should have. And we, it needed to be relatively inexpensive for a piece of furniture. It needed to be robust, because the life cycle of this, it gets so much wear and tear from the kids. It needs to be super strong. It needed to, we thought, needed to have an identity, because almost everybody can remember the chair they sat on at school.
Absolutely, yeah. Sure. Controlled,
yeah. Yeah, sure. We felt we should do that. And of course, the most important thing was movement, but without mechanism. Mm-hmm. And it was, once we'd written this list of criteria, then we just thought, that's impossible.
It sounds
Let's give up.
You can have three out of this five criteria, but not everything.
Yeah.
We show a picture. We YouTube this podcast, so we should definitely show an image.
Yeah. It's, and of course, we finally discovered, you know, we found a way to do it. After lots of experiments, we did find a way to do it. And we, you know, I have to say, Vitra were really part of that conversation. It wasn't, you know, the classic designer, you know, doing a drawing on a napkin and walking away. It was a fight. It was a fight to get there, but it was a collaborative, collaborative effort. With the engineers, with the vision of Vitra, with, you know, and our own kind of passion to get the thing done. And finally, we ended up with this chair, which we really loved, but which was really complicated to make. You know, it's like, it needs a piece of steel that's 20 tons. It has 7 moving parts. It's heated, it's air molded, and the investment was huge. I mean, you know, you could buy a house in London for the investment on the project. Oh. And we thought, at the same time, you know, you've got this thing where we actually had created something which looked slightly unfamiliar, and the interaction was also slightly unfamiliar. So it was risky, because it could have been the biggest investment that flopped, but actually it is so, I think, intuitive to use. After about 90 seconds, you don't look back, and the sales have just gone up and up and up and up, and it's nearly 10 years old.
Oh.
10 years old next year.
Did you, in the process of building such a product, I mean, you have to keep in mind that you have to convince teachers and the people in schools who are buying the furniture. Yep. They said to their kids, don't move with your chair. I remember I always did it. I flew into everything and I would get sent it home.
Yeah.
So you have to convince them. And you have to make sure that kids are really happy with this kind of furniture. In the process of creating a product like this, do you involve kids? Do you involve teachers? How do you do so?
We did. We made prototypes and we tried them out. With my own kids, too.
Well,
in fact, even today, my kids, I have 3 kids, they do their homework on the Tipton chair every night. But what's interesting is the way that the thinking behind the project has influenced the use. So the idea of movement is fundamental to all of us in terms of good posture, concentration, and actually just animating your life. And that, the chair has gone into, has been as well received for business as it has for education, and which is great. And actually a lot of people use them at home for dining chairs. So it's a, it's become a transversal product.
In the process of designing, I mean, you're creating, you're influencing the world of work, of communication in a company. Mm. I just mentioned we sit on the couch soft work, I think mm-hmm. that's what it's called. So yep. It's basically a couch, but it's made for working.
Yeah.
So you have desks built in, you have induction charging devices, you have plugs, and
you sit higher.
You sit yeah. higher. You told us a lot about it.
Yeah.
And people usually ask, like, why would we share stuff like that in a world that is super digital and a lot of technology? And I cannot stress enough, we have this couch from Vita in our space, and it's always the first thing people sit on.
They come to the space,
and the first thing, they sit down and yeah. start something. Let it be a conversation, having coffee or work.
Yeah.
Everyone.
That's great.
It's incredible because it's a good communication device, because you talk different, you're a bit more relaxed, or you don't have a desk in front of yourself. So how does it start to redesign and rethink something like that when people also then just see, oh, that's a culture, it's more than that?
Well, so this is a really good example of, I think the Tipton chair and this project, probably two of my favorite projects, because they haven't come from a sketch, they've come from an observation.
Yeah, insight, really yeah. insight, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this one was, the insight for this was, came from the projects that we've done on our architectural studio, particularly one project, which was the Ace Hotel, which we designed in Shoreditch, mm-hmm. About 2013. And we had made a, you know, the typical thing, you know, like a foyer space for the residents to read the newspaper in the morning or make a call or have a coffee. And one of the most exciting things about what happened on the ground floor of this big hotel on Shoreditch High Street is that it became, in a way, it became another type of space. It became a mixture of the high street and the hotel, and like the middle of the Venn diagram. And then these people in the middle of the Venn diagram were buying coffees all day and working. And it was obviously happening, mm-hmm. you know, it was happening. People were working, you know, because of a number of reasons. One thing was the recession, which led to the beginning of the freelancer economy or mm-hmm. the acceleration mm-hmm. of the freelancer economy. The second thing was that the smartphone liberated us from our desks and workplaces. And so there was this sort of like epicenter of the tech hub of London working in a hotel lobby. Really badly, actually, because the sofas we'd chosen were really relaxed sofas, you know, mm-hmm. it was like they were cool pieces of kind of vintage design, actually. And then the table that we had designed was good. It had some power, but still there was this problem with people working all day ergonomic situation, and the power requirement. So you had these kind of cables going all over the place. Right. So if you didn't end up seeing your chiropractor because of your back, you saw the doctor because you fell over a cable. And we realized that actually there was a need, a desire for people to create these new workplaces, mm. even if they were working by themselves, they wanted colleagues. But that wasn't this world, our world, wasn't accommodating the change fast enough. Mm-hmm. So we had to design, we realized that there was a huge opportunity. So again, there's another letter to Vitra. Hey guys.
The desk is dead.
Yeah. In front of our eyes, it's yeah. dead. We see people in cafes, in lounges, at airports, yeah. in hotel lobbies, everywhere, like doing this or doing mm-hmm. this. And we needed to design a smart answer to that problem.
Hey, just the observation that Starbucks has become a multi-billion dollar company would have been enough to say, well, people want something yes. between work and home.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's why they call it the third place.
Yeah.
And if you're a smart company, you offer them this third place in their yeah. second place, which is office.
Yeah. I mean, the other critical thing is that the other insight from architecture is that actually to create this type of seating in an architectural space, the millwork or the joinery package is actually really expensive because each time it's bespoke. You know, even if it's just a plywood box with some sockets, some upholstered foam seats and back, you know, you're still talking thousands of euros for something which is really mediocre and hasn't been through the rigorous development process and that doesn't give you the flexibility of something like this, which is kind of like grown-up Lego. Mm-hmm. Because you can just buy it piece by piece, assemble it, rearticulate it, add to it. So yeah, we were so excited at the opportunity. And I'm, you know, whilst we're the first to market, I'm sure we won't be the last. There will be many other iterations of this.
When I led a project in my first company, my agency, to create a new office space, and we talked to architects, they told us, yeah, if you want to have a real modern office, and you will give space to, let's say, 200 people, probably you need 600 possibilities to sit for them. I asked, what, 600 for two? Yeah, and they explained, yeah, because there are so many moods. You have to be, there has to be something like a bibliothèque, a bar.
Library,
where you can sit and just work and no one is using a phone. You need different types of space where people sit together. You need space where they can phone. You need, and if you have money and space, we would say 600 places for 200 people. And I think with this kind of furniture, you reduce this maybe down to 300 or 400 because you can create intimacy for one-on-one speeches like we can see there over there. And
you can do that, and it's also about accommodating transiency. So, you know, this kind of shift towards this non-territorial way of working, where traditionally, you know, well, I mean, very traditionally, you have a cellular office, which I think there's still a requirement for total quiet and a certain hierarchy, but the majority of workspaces now are non-territorial, and increasingly as the kind of, you know, as the cost of city center rent goes up, you think that as a company bot owner, you're paying thousands of euros or dollars or pounds for, you know, for essentially a raised surface for someone to have a photograph of their dog and their little cactus on it.
You know. And two big phones and mirrors and a secretary or two.
Yeah, yeah, it's unnecessary. So hopefully this provides something of an antidote to that problem.
What is another really big thing you're currently seeing and you don't have a solution for yet?
Oh, fucking hell. There's a lot.
We're in a podcast. You can say use every
there's
word.
A lot. There's so many things. I won't say too many of them because the competition will start developing things. But, you know, the way that the workplace and work generally is changing is a really interesting thing.
How do you see it as a designer? That, like, from a design perspective, how do you see the workplace changing?
The workplace, I think, ultimately is destined to disappear, really. We're going to end up with another type of space. You know, I think the long-term future is, you know, is about jobs for, I think it's coders and carers. That's the future.
Coders and carers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's the workplace of the future. I think work generally is potentially under threat. You know, is that good? Perhaps that's a good thing. Maybe it's open for redefinition of what work actually is. It could be that we do a lot more social responsible care in the future, and we actually get paid to look after our community more. Mm-hmm. It could be that's the future.
But it's jobs absolutely in line with what Fritjof Bergmann says. He says, well, maybe artificial intelligence and robotics will steal our jobs, but just run through a city. You see, so much of shit is always something to do. Look at the people, they need care, so work may change, but it will be work forever. We have just to be open to see where we could put this energy. So I think
it's challenging because, you know, very quickly following that thread, you end up in a communist state in our minds. Mm-hmm. Let's say, this idea of flatness, of everyone having a minimum wage or everyone being paid to do good work. I think the risk with it is that what we can't do, we're going into politics. I think people like us are born to find the next thing, to do something new. We're not ever going to be happy with just hitting nails into a piece of wood the rest of our life, or even maybe, I mean, maybe actually we would get fulfillment from caring for other people.
Yeah.
Maybe that's true.
One aspect I see in this protocol we're sitting on right now is the sleep aspect. I asked you before, can I sleep here? And when I started together with my partner, my agency, 15 years ago, more than 15 years ago, we said we want a place where
15.
We can sleep. 15, yeah. We want to have a place where we can sleep. Mm. Because we both believe a rest during the day is powerful, and now read the book Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, who said it's good for people to do a nap once a day. How do you see the sleeping topic as a field for workspace? Do you think it is right to offer your employees a place where they can rest for 10, 15, 30 minutes?
I mean, I've never really seen it in the workplace. I mean, I've done it.
We all done it.
Yeah, exactly. Then you call it like the Pfennig. Mm-hmm. Isn't it something about holding a penny? Mm-hmm. And then when you drop it, that's time to wake up.
Yeah, you should. The story goes like this. You drink an espresso before, and then you lay down with this penny, and after 15 minutes, you...
It puts you off.
So whenever I travel, especially if it's a long-haul flight, and then I have something to do, I tend to just walk into my room. It doesn't matter, like, fully dressed. I just lie on the bed, and I set my thing for 17 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's what I do. I try to do, anyway. But I like the idea. And actually, funnily enough, when we were developing this, Rolf had actually asked us about the topic of sleep, because I think it is, you know, thinking suggests that it is the right thing to do. It's just hard to imagine how you could facilitate it in an open plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because it would look like a kind of an attack has just happened and everyone's been knocked out.
Yeah, but this is maybe you ask for it. Where do you see a space where there's no solution?
Yeah.
I think there is no solution, because you can read it in so many articles that it's good. There's too much pressure on
people in open spaces doing it.
We had in this first office, we had this little room. The problem was, we said to everyone can use it, so it's just closed or open.
Yeah.
Don't use it longer than 30 minutes. But it was next to our office. No one really. It took, I think, a year, and they could see. Well, Andre and Michael, they use it. They really use it, and then people started to use it as well. But I don't know.
Well, I mean, in the sort of lower Latin Mediterranean countries, it's fine. The siesta is part of culture, isn't it?
How is nature influencing the workplace? Is that something you get inspired by with ideas?
It's very hard to do that without feeling like it's a pastiche, isn't it? I mean, obviously we've seen the return of the plants.
True.
You know, they were definitely not around in the 90s with minimalism. Yeah. It was like,
gone.
But they're back. And I think, obviously, if you're lucky enough to have a building that's situated in such a way that you can create those views, so you can feel immersed in it, or even split up the programming of your place so that you can walk through nature, walk through a view, or be outside to come back inside, is important.
I'm asking for a special reason. Again, I know Katinka is very influenced by the plants, by nature and design. And also when we talk about communication companies, and Michael always comes with the example of the MIT building, where they...
Building 20, you probably know the
building 20. Yeah. And I recently dived into the topics of like how is wood organized, like a forest.
Yeah.
And the plants are living very symbiotic, like the trees need the plants, like everyone needs them themselves, and they're close together, and it looks like a big chaos, like a big mess, but it's a very well organized, very efficient thing. And I thought, like, that's an interesting idea, because when we see an office space that is open, we still kind of want to structure it in certain ways. And I'm wondering, like, this influence you have with the Building 20 that gives certain, by accident, symbiotic inspiration to other people. How can we enforce this? Another example could be Steve Jobs' urban legend that he wanted to have all the toilets in just one place.
No, it was
place.
Bill Gates. It was Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm. Was it?
So that everyone has to walk by the toilet because they have to go there, so they meet there.
Yeah.
With unplanned collaboration, unplanned communication.
That is probably the last place I'd want to collaborate.
Yeah, of course, but you have to go there and you meet someone on the way or on the way back because there are people coming to the office and hiding behind a screen all day long, right? At a certain point, they have to go.
You know, I think there's something actually not so great about open plan working because, in a way, it's just become the shop floor.
Yeah.
You know, with the bosses high up looking down, making sure that everyone's working, you do feel vulnerable. That's why this sort of idea of screening, you know, actually that really started with the alcove sofa that the
new intimacy, a new kind of intimacy without giving everyone its own room. Yeah,
it's really difficult. I actually think long term we'll see definitely we will see the sort of cellular office return to some extent because people need. I mean, the thing that happens, of course, in open plan offices is especially in the creative world is everyone listens to the music. So really, it's not good. No, you become disassociated from your colleagues. You know, you're in your own world. You don't really share.
Yeah.
So it's a problem. It's problematic. And maybe we'll see the end of that. And after all, we're still talking about desks in that configuration. Yeah. Mm. And maybe that goes.
I think this would be the wrong thing to come back to this old system. I think we should really work hard on this. How can I make sure that everyone who needs intimacy has the chance to get it immediately? Mm. Like a place like this or the headquarter of Vitra, I could see that they have some boxes where you can lay in and it's all covered. And you just by moving your head half a meter into, or not 20 centimeters into this box, you noise is gone and you have your own. I think I would love to see more of this, or a library where lots of people can sit next to each other. I mean, we had an author, a lady who sold millions of books. She's doing the writing in the library of Hamburg University because it's the best and the quietest place. And you see people and you have all this interaction. I don't think that it's right to go back to this two people share an office. I don't think so.
No, but I also think I also think that we have to ask ourselves what the workplace, what's the point of it? Hmm. And actually the only thing that's important now about the workplace, if you're not actually making something with your own hands, is to interact with other people. It's just meetings. Yeah. It's a meeting place now. Hmm. You know, you can work anywhere. So really what we're having to do is think about how to bring people together in the best way.
It's a communication tool.
Yes, it is. It's of exchanging ideas, but more than exchanging ideas, because you can do that on the phone or by email. Yeah. It's about being able to have conversations where you know, the third thing. It's not visual and it isn't audio. It's actually something else that we haven't.
Yeah, it's community. It's communication and community. For me, it's sometimes I go into a broader space in the office where I see there are other people. I sit there, do my work. They see I'm concentrated. They don't talk to me, but I have this feeling I'm part of something bigger. I think this is an aspect which is important as well. I would love to switch to one topic because I Katinka prepared me very good. So I saw that you the designer of this floss light which you can carry around. So
the bellhop.
Bellhop. I did develop two offices for my company on as a project leader. And the worst thing in every project was light followed by sound. But as I saw this. I never worked with it. I just saw pictures. But I mean, this is the solution. Everyone gets his light.
Can you
light.
Describe it?
Yeah, it's a little. We will put it into the video as well.
I should have brought one with me. Actually,
it's a little light like a Taschenlampe. What is Taschenlampe?
Flashlight.
Like a flashlight, but a flashlight you put on your table and you have perfect light. You can read. You can work. You can carry it around. So it's like with an accumulator. You don't need.
We had this in the other video that you guys were recording.
I love it. Indeed. I will buy it.
It's been massively successful. I have to admit, I'm very happy about it.
Yeah.
And it's LED, so it doesn't need a plug. It's
no, you plug it in. You can plug it. It's USB-C, so you can plug it in and leave it plugged in.
Yeah.
Or you can just take it out. It's like for us, the way that we thought about it actually was how. Again, going back 100 years, is about how you would go into your house, you would light the candle, and then you would walk.
Walk. Right.
So I was reading the memoirs of my great aunt, so my granddad's sister, and she was saying, she said that when they were at the time they were growing up, they could only afford gas lights downstairs. There was no lighting upstairs at all. And so they used to take the candle up the stairs, and her brother, my grandfather, would stand at the stairs and hold the candle and scare her when she was a child. And that idea of mobility of light was the thing that started that project, this idea that you can take it anywhere. Plus, you can take it outside.
I've seen something comparable by a social organization that is helping Africa. It's a light which changes the life of a family. If they get light, the kids can, because they have no electricity, the kids can do their homework.
It's amazing. They
stuff like this.
I've seen that too. Yeah. It's really important because it's transformative. People can, the days are extended. It doesn't mean that you can, of course you can, if you're doing piece work, so if you're doing work as well in the evening to bring extra revenue in, it's good. Kids to do their homework is fantastic. But I think we're going to see with photovoltaics, and particularly in Africa and other emerging economies, the transformation that battery power is going to bring. You know, where you can't get a cable in, you can't get power to it or energy. The future of batteries is the way.
Yeah.
What are your most important tools for design? I always see you, of course, running around with a pin. But I mean,
That's the most important thing is your pencil.
That's it.
But I was thinking of 3D printing for prototypes, iPad. There are so many things that you could use as tools today.
Yeah.
Give a little bit of glimpse into the modern design process.
Well, unfortunately, I can't really. Because I think the tools that we use more or less are the same as they always have been for the inception of an idea, which is a pencil, a pen, a paper, and then making models quickly. We don't any longer do drafting by hand, although we were trained to draw by hand, of course, for engineering drawings and architectural drawings. But we're luckily in the position to be able to hire people who are really good at it, who can take a sketch and turn it into a 3D model. We do lots of model making by hand very quickly. So, if we discuss a concept or an idea first thing in the morning, by lunchtime, we have a thing normally to talk about or to respond to. And it's important for us that model making makes something real in space. So we can, as you can see on the wall behind you, we can render things and look at it, examine it on the screen, but it could be a pencil or it could be the Titanic on the screen. It's irrelevant. It doesn't have any sense of scale, or it's not until you realize something one-to-one that you understand its feeling in the space. So with Ed and I, we get as far as really drawing and model making, but the team then will interpret the sketch into something which is tangible. We often use 3D printing now, whereas before we just used hand making. 3D printing is actually probably better environmentally, although it takes energy, it uses less resource because it's a smaller thing at the end. And very quickly, something that we agree on goes to the company, to Vitra, say, and Vitra then take it on. It's like a relay race, sketch to prototype, sketch to model, model to prototype, prototype to second prototype. The realization is like a race. Each person plays their role in that. And really, the communication is almost entirely done through drawing. Even when you have a prototype, you're still drawing. You draw on it, or you draw next to it, or you draw on a plan or a picture. So without that, it would be impossible. It's also one of the reasons why us English people haven't learned any new languages, because we just draw instead.
Now I lost my question. I thought it was the most important question. Yeah, now I got it back. Never happened before, so everything happens first. How do you see the future of the job profile of a designer when you see it, the first approaches of artificial intelligence, machine learning, helping to create designs?
Oh, good question.
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm going to say it doesn't stand a chance. I think the one thing I have noticed, though, is that there are a lot fewer design graduates applying now for jobs.
Wow.
I think what has happened is that the combination, I'm talking specifically about the UK, although I think it's a bigger issue, I think that the combination of the cost of education now and the risk of learning to do something which isn't so well paid potentially compared to the digital arts. So the idea of what we're seeing is the creative thinkers are going much more into technology now, mm-hmm. and applying their brains to other problems. I suspect it's the right thing to do, probably, because, you know, we could argue that, with some exceptions, we are kind of catered for as a species in terms of the made answers to everyday life, to chairs, to sofas, to tables, things which no longer rely on technology. New technologies to advance mm-hmm. them. I think we're done, more or less. We don't really need that much more. We need things which can adapt to the way that society is changing, which is why this is valid, mm-hmm. and maybe why the Tipton chair is valid. I think those opportunities are becoming fewer and fewer, and so I understand why the next generation aren't attracted to something, because the job is done.
Do you think
that... I don't think so.
Me neither. I'm also challenging so
that
it.
Good, let's do it.
That your job is so important. Mm. At least in my old industry, advertising, I believe the brand designers are the ones who can do their job for many more years, because all the beauty in the world has to do with something you create, and I don't think that machines will, maybe they will assist us. I strongly believe more in augmented intelligence. Yeah. They help you to do your job better.
Yeah.
But that's what you said, that you observe things with this chair. I don't think that a machine could come out with a
machine.
What I mean,
I'll just qualify that. What I mean is that creative thinking. We depend on creative thinking. We will more than ever depend on it as we move forward to keep an eye on technology, I guess. I don't personally feel threatened by AI and the future of that. I think it's within our power to control it and understand it. What I really mean is that in terms of producing commodities, the idea of the Bauhaus of good design for everybody kind of exists, really, through people like IKEA, mm-hmm. really. I think IKEA have done an incredible job of fulfilling the Bauhaus's prophecy. I just question whether we need more stuff. So in terms of designers creating more stuff, we don't need that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of course you need things, we will always need things that lift your soul, but some of that is about find discovery. I mean, there are enough beautiful chairs that have been created that can lift our souls when we find them. I don't always believe that we need more stuff.
The lounge chair is already there since years. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, there's a point where you have to say, okay, maestro, you were right. Yeah.
but AI can be a tool for this observation process, for example. Like when you came up with, you see something, you observe something, and it gives us insights that are much different.
And that's what I doubt. What we see, that a machine, you have to make sure that the machine gets the right data. But what kind of data leads you that kids are behaving like this in school? I think until the point where machines are able to do so, we will need 20, 30, 40 more years.
I agree. I think it can assist the process, like coming up
combining
with
data,
small spark. Mm. Like stupid example, I know you hate my Snapchat, TikTok and stuff examples, but for example...
You're such a young kid, you can play on TikTok.
Thank you. But why, for example, is that an interesting app to keep in mind? Because the algorithm works much different than YouTube, for example. Mm-hmm. Even Mark Zuckerberg said, oh, it's dangerous, we need to do something. And if a guy like him says something, you have to look at that and say, what is happening here? And if you dive into it a little bit, the Chinese have come up with an app with an algorithm. And we discussed it the other night with the Blackboard crew, that is totally different. You really have to dive into that and see what the fuck is happening here. I mean,
why is it different?
Yeah, it the AI really goes into how do you look the videos, which one do you swipe in, which one do you really see? Not just a little bit, but so good that you you stop using this follow button to follow people because you get content that you get suggested and you think like it's entertaining, it's funny, and you stumble upon things that are very creative and you can say it's nonsense, but it sparks something. It
sure,
does something.
I see what you mean.
And if we That's put...
Especially
and I see,
for TikTok or?
This is especially true for TikTok. I would like have to dive much deeper into that, but like you see the success of this app and then you see some adults reacting to it and say like, yeah, but this is kid stuff. It's not interesting. No. And I've seen it happening so many times that we underestimate the influence here. And the big difference is that this is so AI driven already that even the US companies have the feeling, okay,
yeah, that's what they,
we got to do something about it. And that's what I see. And that's why I'm listening so closely to you, because the power of having then an idea that inspires something because you saw something as a designer, which you look much different at things.
Yeah.
That's a big new field that I could imagine.
Well, you see, for me, I use some, I mean, I look at Instagram occasionally. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not anti-progress or technology. But for me, I think the majority of social media, a lot of social media, is almost like it's the opium of the masses, right? It's like the ultimate distraction.
Yeah.
It's distracting us from really big things which are happening in the world that we should probably be a little bit more worried about. And actually, we're not. We're absorbed in these sort of moments, which, you know, there's a place for it. I think we have to keep it in proportion, though. And in terms of being inspired, I can honestly tell you that I don't think I've really been inspired by things on screen apart from cinema and film. The spaciousness of film, the colors, the emotion, the immersion in it is inspiring for me. Instagram, I find it one of the most irritating things.
This will be our line for our Instagram post. Wow. Yeah.
Sorry, is that bad?
No, it's
no,
cool.
No, no,
it's great.
No, no.
I think to have a clear position in this direction helps you not to.
It's difficult though, because you get, I'm like, I'm 50 years old, right? Yeah. So the minute you say don't like Instagram, you end up just feeling like your grandfather who said turn the television off and go outside and play in the garden. You know, it's like.
No, I agree on that. It's like opium. I mean, it definitely makes people addictive. And if you don't know how to deal with it, it's difficult. What I'm saying is like to observe things and to see, okay, what is happening? And it feels very similar to a process when you say like, oh, I observed that kids have to move. There is something happening.
Yeah.
And to see how this is changing, because technology plays a big part in everyday work and we all hide behind these screens.
Yeah.
And this is the one thing I'm always challenging, and we had a big discussion, how can we get away the screens in the company? And when we have to work on the screen.
But why
can we
not
get
always.
Away?
Why do you?
Not always.
Why do you?
Yeah. I would say we put them away very often compared to other companies that are working in the same field like we do. And we kind of hide them away in at the office, but it's hard to like get rid of it.
It's an excuse. I think, honestly, you'd find it so much more productive if people didn't. Okay, we have to produce information as designers, okay? And okay, you have to answer emails. But what's happened? If you hire anybody under 30 now and you say, oh, can you just call the guy about that? And then the next day you say, oh, what did the guy say? And they say, oh, he hasn't emailed me back yet.
Yeah,
for fuck's sake, pick up the phone. Like, we just phone people and then we know, right?
Yeah,
don't
true.
Hide behind your screen.
Yeah, that's true.
It's pathetic. It's fucking pathetic.
Yeah. Your partner said that he thinks one of the biggest problems with the younger generation of designers is that they believe they can do their whole job behind the screen.
Yeah.
And the whole hour we spent with you, I now realize.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really it's painful. It's painful, but it's kind of countercultural to be retrospective in our thinking at the moment. It's not what our society is. You know, we haven't been taught to do that, to be this way. So you end up feeling like a kind of arts and crafts, like flipping, I don't know, William Morris, you know, this reaction against industrialization. We aren't that really. It's just that we know, we remember how work was and how productivity was high before smartphones, for example.
Yeah. I mean, we could be much higher with the technology if we would use it
we need
more
to challenge
wisely.
Actually, this is a really interesting topic. I haven't really talked about this before, but you're right. There's a hybrid way of working, which is probably a lot more to do with meetings, but productive meetings, because meetings are also an environment where people hide behind, you know, meetings for meetings. Let's have a meeting. Okay, that was a great meeting. Let's meet again on Thursday. You know, it's like,
oh no, I have two other meetings on Thursday. How about?
Okay, we'll have to reschedule the meeting. You know, and then you have to finish that meeting. It was like a fantastic meeting, but let's follow up. You know, it's like, you don't need to. You just need to meet, make a decision, go. I don't know. Anyway, obviously I'm getting a bit...
Yeah, so I told you before I wanted to discuss with you about Brexit, but I don't want any more, because it was such a nice hour we spent together. And I think, last question to you?
Yeah, like one very important question you always ask, like, if you would give advice to, let's say, a 12-year-old listening, saying, okay... Looking on the field of work, or what's your passion, what advice would you give someone who's that young?
Well, it's really, I've got kids that age. I have a 17-year-old, a 14-year-old, and an 11-year-old. The 17-year-old is interested, she's studying bizarre A-levels, which is really good. You know, she's doing politics, she's doing English literature, and she's doing textile design.
Wow.
Now, she's my daughter, right? So she's suffering from my problem of not wanting to commit to one discipline or another, I think. The middle child, Sophia, she's determined to be a pilot, okay? She's also an environmentalist, so she wants to be the first girl to fly the hydrogen plane or whatever. And Felix is, he really is interested in how things go together.
Oh, wow.
So he's interested in design engineering or something like that. He doesn't really know
yet.
Probably
a maker.
Yeah, he's brilliantly dyslexic as well. Way more dyslexic than me. So he's, I mean, you don't know which way up he is half the time. So I often get this thing. It's like, I come home and it's like, shit, I come home and I'm sort of looking at them thinking, what are you going to do, you guys? And I think my advice to everybody, my honest advice to people is try and avoid get a job. Trying to avoid getting a job. First, try and find a way to do your thing. And I think that comes from, it's, of course, it's really difficult, I'm sure, but my parents, my grandparents, and other people in my family were like shopkeepers, you know? As you know, England was a country of shopkeepers. And I can remember the difficulty of having your own business, but also the joys of it. And I think if anything, the future is really concerned with what you can do as an individual in your own world and thinking about it like that, rather than being a cog in the machine, you know, working for the man.
I would say let's leave it exactly like this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jay.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed that. Thanks.
Same with us.